Thank you, Ginny. It's great to be here. I landed at 6 a.m. this morning from India. I want to thank caffeine and Ambien for the great invention. If you remember, actually, Ambien was developed by Sanofi Synthol Labeaux way back. So anyway, 10 milligrams was my dose, if anybody wants to know. Anyway, as a way... Exactly. Yes, not a double whammy.
Yes. Thank you. Sequence is important. Yeah, we should talk about
sequence.
That.
The dose.
It was not Rogaine and Viagra, looking at my hair. Anyway, as a way of background, 3 to 4 years ago, we probably would not have a panel on the tumor microenvironment. And I think it's because we all thought that the first generation and second generation checkpoint antibodies were going to give us that magical synergy, take us to the promised land. So obviously, with Bristol-Myers a couple of years ago, there was a lot of expectation that the combination of PD-1 and CTLA-4 was going to be dramatic in lung cancer. There was hope that maybe that would become first line in kidney cancer, maybe head and neck. And then we had the disappointing lung cancer data. And then beyond CTLA-4 and PD-1, we all thought OX40, 4-1BB, GITR, TIM-3, LAG-3, VISTA, a lot of other second-generation checkpoint antibodies. We all thought some of them would take us to the magical synergy. What is the magical synergy? I guess getting a 50% response rate. As one of my friends in managed care said, if you have a 1 out of 2 chance, you may not need a biomarker may not be needed. But if it's 1 out of 4, 1 out of 5, you probably do need to stratify. But if you can get to that 50% response rate, 50% clinical impact, it might be hard to argue that you probably need to stratify. But overall, the second-generation checkpoints, I would say, have been slower than expectations. I wouldn't write them all off, but they haven't taken us to the promised land. Then the pendulum swung to IDO, a lot of expectations, a lot of hope. As you know, a few weeks ago, we had a big setback with IDO. At the beginning of the year, we saw a huge deal between Bristol-Myers and Nektar. Now there's 15 IL-2s, IL-15s. That area is proliferating, but just a word of caution, there's really no randomized data. So we all hope it works, but there's also not a lot of monotherapy data with some of the IL-2 mutines. So again, I'm sure the panel will talk about the importance of monotherapy activity. So the TME is a topic of discussion today. It's ripe for new targets that we can combine with PD-1. As I said, one of the key questions is, what are the optimal combinations? What are the priorities? And do we need to see monotherapy as a filter before we go into combination? I think the good news on the TME is there's a lot of abundant targets. We've got chemokines, cytokines, MDSCs, TAMs. We have the extracellular matrix, the cancer-associated fibroblasts in pancreatic, the fibrotic nests. So again, a lot of opportunities here, a lot of abundant targets. And many of the existing drugs do modify the TME. We may hear something about chemotherapy, some of the anti-angiogenics. There was a publication recently on COX-2 possibly playing a role in the TME, some of the kinase inhibitors. So I want to just I'll let the panel, each person say who they are, but I think one of the key questions is, how do we prioritize all of these targets and therapies? But let's keep one thing in mind. The tumor is still the smartest immunologist. So, Tom, maybe you
Ouch.
Well, we can debate that. Hopefully we are. But so far, the tumors are pretty smart. Anyway, let me let each of the panelists introduce themselves, and I'll let Tom lead off with a few slides.
Tom Gajewski from the University of Chicago. I do cancer immunology from bench to bedside and back and forth, I guess.
Lou?
Lou Keltner. I consult for quite a few cancer immunotherapy companies and teach bioethics at Columbia.
Good morning. Tim Riley. I head up early development oncology at Bristol-Myers Squibb.
Bob Schneider, I'm associate dean at NYU School of Medicine. I head up drug discovery, new company development, and I'm also representing END Therapeutics, which is an immuno-oncology company that has drugged the tumor stroma.
Dimitri Zamarin, Memorial Sloan Kettering Cancer Center. I'm a clinical medical oncologist and also lead laboratory research in cancer immunotherapy.
Terrific. Tom, I think you have a few slides, so maybe you can frame this.
I don't know if I can see them unless I stand
yep,
up.
Yep, please. Yep.
Maybe move this. Oh, no, I can see them here. Well, I'll still stand. So I thought I would. I just have three slides as a setup for thinking about the tumor microenvironment as the focal point of discussion about cancer immunotherapies and does this actually work? And PD-1 itself was pursued, PD-1 blockade, because of its functional relevance directly in the tumor microenvironment. If you remember when CTLA-4 blockade was first being investigated, it wasn't exactly clear where the negative impact of CTLA-4 might be on T cells in the draining lymph node, in other secondary lymphoid structures in the tumor. What was special at the time about PD-1 was that PD-1 was on tumor-infiltrating T cells, and the ligand PD-L1 was on antigen-presenting cells and tumor cells in the tumor microenvironment. So this is targeting immune processes in the stroma. And so one way to think about this then is the T cell inflamed and non-T cell inflamed tumor subsets, and where can we go next in terms of furthering activity in the T cell inflamed tumors beyond PD-1, PD-L1 blockade alone? And then are there new ways to think about overcoming barriers in the tumor microenvironment for the non-T cell inflamed subset? And many of you are probably familiar with these kinds of data with gene expression profiling for immune transcripts in the tumor. And this was a publication driven by Merck, pembrolizumab, single-agent activity in a variety of tumors, and using the nanostring platform. And two of these cancers shown here, head and neck cancer and gastric cancer, if patients are low or negative for this immune gene signature, they almost never respond to single-agent anti-PD-1, and the responders are enriched in the immune-infiltrated subset. But we have two bins of non-responders here. We have patients who have an immune infiltrate and didn't respond to single agent, and then we've got patients who did not have an immune infiltrate and didn't respond to single agent. So I think just for ease of thinking about mechanism, we should approach these two as separate primary resistance categories. That's the way we think about it in our group. And so in the T-cell inflamed subset, let's say you have activated T cells, they get recruited into the tumor microenvironment because of inflammatory signals, chemokines, and those T cells are held in check by negative regulation. What else is being considered to try and expand beyond what anti-PD-1 alone can do? It's already been alluded to, but I think we can break it down into logical subsets, a blockade of additional negative regulatory pathways that could sort of salvage the inhibitory aspect of the tumor microenvironment, provision of positive factors, so ligation of costimulatory receptors or cytokines, other factors that will provide positive signals to those T cells. And then what's recently gaining traction is, why are those T cells struggling to begin with? They're activated T cells, they're specific for tumor antigens, they're trying to do their job in the tumor microenvironment. But there are several papers and more to come about how these T cells are really working hard, and they're dying by apoptosis. They have metabolic limitations. So is there some way we can just target this as a biologic process and then just allow the T cells to do their work? The second category of the non-T cell inflamed, how do we turn cold tumors into hot? One way to think about this is, what's missing from the non-T cell inflamed tumors? So obviously, they have few or no T cells, as particularly CD8-positive T cells. The key dendritic cell subset that's responsible for activating CD8 T cells is missing. Probably because the CD8 T cells are missing, properly activated macrophages are missing. The inflammatory signals for the recruitment of these cell subsets are missing. And then the vasculature is kind of a cold vasculature. So there might not even be, if you think of T cells swimming through the blood, seeing the lumen, the wall of the lumen or the vasculature, there's no address, to tell them, aha, this is the place to stop and get out, right? So if we're going to manipulate this kind of tumor, what is present, right? What kind of cells are present in those tumors? So if you think about TLR agonists and so on, I think it's important to think about what cells and TLRs or innate immune receptors are actually there to be engaged. So, I mean, you always have tumor cells, obviously, macrophages and perhaps some other myeloid cells, fibroblasts, and then endothelial cells. So I think these are the cell types that are almost always there. you know, there are what might come up in discussion, key dendritic cell subsets and so on that are not there, and so engaging TLRs that are specific to those cells that are not there is less logical. And then besides all these features of the tumor, there are host variables that impact on the nature of the endogenous anti-tumor immune response. There are germline variants that are being uncovered that also might be druggable. The proteins encoded by those genes might be druggable. And then the work on the gut microbiota is a factor that sort of shapes the degree of that infiltration at baseline. So this gives us sort of opportunities to think about interventions outside the tumor microenvironment, but that will impact on the tumor microenvironment. So that's just a kind of a setup for the discussion.
Tom, thank you. That was a great great way to frame the discussion. Maybe since we're in New York, we'll go left to right, since New York is, of course, a left-wing city. But Dimitri, tell us what targets in the TME you're excited about and what other aspects of the TME are really exciting your work and, again, that magical synergy with PD-1, if PD-1, of course, is foundational.
Sure. I mean, I can tell you what targets I was excited about 5 years ago and maybe the targets that I'm excited about now. It's and quite honestly, those targets have not changed. You know, it's probably the same targets. One of the issues that I would like to add to Tom's introduction is that while we know that we have certain components of the microenvironment that we'd like to target, we don't always have a good way to define them based on even looking at the patient's tissue. For example, take an MDSC, which is this nebulous immunosuppressive population that everybody's still arguing, what exactly is this cell? And can we stain for MDSCs in the tumor tissue? Well, we don't really have a good stain to define that basically. Is this a suppressive macrophage or a myeloid cell, or is this a stimulatory? There is no really good biomarker for us to really define that this is the kind of tumor that needs to be targeted with this specific drug. So yes, I'm very excited about the drugs that need to target the myeloid compartment. The question is, do we have a specific drug that's targeting the suppressive compartment or not? Can we define what is the suppressive compartment, at least based on the information we have? And we're unfortunately still very limited in that. But I would basically say that I think universally it is accepted that, you know, myeloid populations in tumors in general tend to be suppressive. Regulatory T cells in the tumors in general tend to be suppressive. There's a wide variability in how we, you know, how we see the predominance of these specific cell types within the tumors, but we unfortunately don't know what is the right amount of cells, and not even what the cells are to define that whether this is the target that we should be using. But in general, I guess if I wanted to list all of my favorite sort of a target. So yes, I would love to have drugs that are specifically targeting suppressive myeloid compartment. I would love to have drugs that are specifically are able to eliminate the regulatory T cells, the immunosuppressive T cell population. And for me specifically, I was brought up as a virologist initially, so I'm really interested in targeting the innate compartment. And there is emerging data now coming out that suggests that targeting the innate compartment, not even systemically, but even within a single tumor, can really provoke the immune response in other sites. So I will leave it with those three and let others add.
Yeah. Bob, your views?
Thank you. So we have deliberately drugged the tumor microenvironment. Starting in the 1990s, we began work on the endothelin B receptor and showed that it's required for metastasis, melanoma, and a number of other cancers. And over the years, both we and George Kukos's lab found that it's actually another checkpoint, immunological checkpoint. It causes a downregulation of ICAM, and that prevents T-cell trafficking. And so roughly half of tumors overexpress the endothelin B receptor, but so do their stromal fibroblasts, and so does the vasculature. And work has shown from our group and George's group and others that the downregulation of the endothelin B receptor actually results in remarkable T-cell infiltration. And recently we've demonstrated in anti-PD-1 in tumors that are completely resistant to PD-1 and in PDX models, that we can actually restore complete clearance in these animals as well. We have a little bit of data from direct injection in humans as well. So we've drugged it. We have small molecules. We're hoping to get accelerated status to enter the clinic at the end of the year from the FDA. We have designed several different small molecule drugs so that they have short clearance time in the serum, and I'll explain why in a moment, and that's something we need to be careful about when we think about the tumor microenvironment, but a very long on-target residence time for the receptor itself. And we've done this in several ways, and we have a nanoparticle formulation that crosses the blood-brain barrier. And so why do we need to be careful? Well, it turns out that some of the receptors that we're all thinking about drugging and that we have drugged do have, of course, other functions. And the function of the endothelin B receptor on the vasculature is to regulate blood pressure. And so years ago, there were a series of drugs made to actually downregulate blood pressure, both to the endothelin A and B receptor, hence the name of our company, ENB Therapeutics. We're really inventive, but it works. So we deliberately went in that fashion. Genentech created an antibody to the endothelin B receptor. Unfortunately, they linked a toxin to it, which I thought was ill-advised. And so while they did have some interesting late phase one, early phase two data and showed efficacy, it was too toxic. We don't think we're going to have that problem, certainly not based on the animal studies that we have done. And our dosing is quite a bit lower as well. So an antibody would not be the way to go. So what we need to think about as we're moving forward to start drugging the stroma are the other functions of these receptors. And so we need to think about, in terms of the chemistry of the drugs that we develop, how to keep them on the receptor for long residence times but cleared from the serum, which is actually the opposite to the way that generally drugs are developed in pharma, which is to try to keep them in serum for the longer period of time. This is the sixth company I've helped develop, starting with ImClone 35 years ago as a co-founder. So I think at least we have the gravitas to create drugs the way we think we should. The other thing is that we need to be thinking about, as we drug the tumor stroma, that these have to be synergistic interactions. And so we have moved forward in those spaces in which there's a very poor, if any, anti-PD-1 effect. And at least in animal tumor models, we have seen, and PDX models, seen really excellent effects, to the point at which we're actually producing what are known as TLOs, or temporary lymphoid organs, which are basically immune factories that may even be restoring T-cell memory as well.
You guys in the clinic with that small molecule?
We're hoping to be in the clinic in the next 12 to 18 months. We have another FDA meeting in June.
Are there a whole series of backup compounds? Or
there are several. We have peptide-based, peptide-based drugs, and we have a small molecule behind as well. We have several different formulations and different chemistries.
Did the naked antibody fail, or has anybody taken a naked?
So once again, the problem with the naked antibody is the serum distribution and serum residence time is far too high. And so you have real problems there in terms of hypertension. Gotcha. Right? And that's what we try to avoid.
Tim, your favorite targets, themes in the TME?
Well, so I'm going to talk more about themes, I would say. So I feel like we're sort of in the third phase of immunotherapy. I think with CTLA-4 initially and ipilimumab and then the results that we've observed with PD-1 therapies, PD-L1 therapies over time, we've really started to learn what tumor types are responsive, what tumor types are not responsive. And even as recently as AACR a few weeks ago, we've now sort of gotten through into the second stage where we really can start to dissect out where PD-1 therapies, plus or minus chemotherapy, plus or minus CTLA therapy, starts to prove to show benefit. I think it's really exciting times because we can start to now dissect out PD-L1, TMB as predictive markers, at least to be able to sort of funnel patients towards the higher likelihood of success. But I think I was really reflecting upon the comments this morning's panel. We're sort of now entering the third phase. And the third phase is really to try and take the diversity of things that Tom talked about and take a portfolio of agents and try to really understand biology. If you can understand biology, not just sort of grossly in a particular tumor, But in an individual patient and in a variety of their tumors over time, you can start to pair up biological changes with the mechanisms that you have at your fingertips. At BMS, the approach we've taken purposefully, because the tumor is incredibly brilliant immunologically, is to develop a really deep portfolio of lots of different mechanisms. And we've done that purposefully because we think that what you really need to do is start to apply different things as you understand them. So I was reflecting upon David's comments this morning. We would love to biopsy a patient every day if we could. We really would. We would love to learn more. We take lots of solace around trying to understand what's going on in each individual patient and use each patient as an individual experiment to understand what's going on in that patient, when they respond and then eventually relapse, when they don't respond. We try to use that information so that we can learn and apply the next grouping of agents so we can understand in subpopulations of patients who don't respond, is it because they have particular cell types or even subsegments of cell types that are responding differently, and we can start to pair up that phenotype, that observation with agents. So what I'm most excited about is the opportunity to get to this stage of real, true precision medicine, and precision medicine that's testable. It's not just theory. Testable, where you can actually take a patient's biopsy, understand what's going on immunologically and with the tumor cell itself, and at least address the hypothesis immediately. We've started a study with Tom's colleague, Jason Luke, just recently, where we're going to start to do that. We're going to take a biopsy in a real time, analyze it, and based upon the analysis of that tumor biopsy, give a patient up to 8 different combinations to be able to pair biology with an opportunity to address that person's needs.
Lou, your view on targets in the TME or themes that you think are particularly exciting?
Sure. Sort of a bit of a counterpoint to Tim's comments, a couple of macro comments. We will and we can debate, and I think the debate will get better and better, the tumor microenvironment and the science with specific targets in the TME. Now, the reality is there's lots of human and preclinical data now showing that, if we just apoptotically, immunogenically ablate the tumor, number one, we get rid of the tumor, and number two, we engage new clones of CD8 T cells to neoantigens in the tumor. So this has not been a very popular strategy. It's been too device-heavy. But the fact is there's plenty of data out there in human randomized clinical trials showing that it works. So that doesn't mean that we don't debate the science, we don't debate specific targets, but there's a simple macro way to start the process. Just get rid of the tumor and engage the immune system, and then the specific targets to make sure that the engagement of the immune system works are things that are kind of a second step. Second, a macro comment is that because of the work of the recent work of Glinsky and others now showing that the small RNA sequences coming from the endogenous human retrovirome have such utterly profound power in the control of lethal cancers and also in the control of CTLA-4 and PD-1 resistance, I think this is going to shake the foundations of what we're doing, because this is new work. It's fairly unknown. There's a huge amount of work going on about the influences of retroviruses in life in general, in plants and animals. It's an exploding field. But in cancer, the data are pretty staggering. And so once we start deliberately drugging those small RNA sequences, I think we're going to see very different things happening in tumors that will change our whole view of the tumor microenvironment and of targets. Then a couple of specific comments. I think that as we see some human data coming from some of the bispecifics that really are designed to do a much better job of engaging CD8 T cells, I mean, things like our friend Taylor Schreiber's bispecifics that are specifically designed to do that, I think we may see some real differences and some real differences in combinations and some real differences in terms of what we see with PD-1, which, of course, is the big elephant in the room. I also think that there is some human clinical data coming out now, and several of you have mentioned this. I mean, Tom had it on his slides. The clinical data that's coming out of Noxon's A12 CXCL12 inhibitor is awfully interesting. And so, that small molecule that's shutting down CXCL12 really is showing some odd results in tumors, and I mean odd in a positive way in terms of the way tumor cells bind to each other. I think there are also some interesting work that should be available showing what happens with PD-1 when we use some small molecule, much higher affinity, much longer half-life anti-PD-1s, you know, like the ones coming out of Reflexion Pharma in San Francisco, in terms of PD-1 resistance and what happens, and do those longer half-lives and lower toxicities really mean anything? And then I'll second Mark's comments on the IL-2, IL-15. You know, this is a really interesting area, but there is this enormous vacuum of randomized data. And in the last few weeks, I've had the fortunate or unfortunate experience of arguing with some companies in the field that, could you please design some trials to give us randomized data? Because we really need it desperately.
Lou, on the RNA sequences and the retroviral, you were mentioning, are those mostly academic pursuits, or are there some companies that actually are looking at that area?
There's only one company, and I conflict of interest. It's my company, but it's Dr. Glinsky and I, and he's the one who first discovered the power of these sequences. There are lots of publications coming out now where folks are discovering in lethal cancers, oh my gosh, we're seeing expression of sequences off the human retrovirome. We don't really know what those are, but gee, this is intriguing. We've seen it. We've seen publications in lung, we've seen publications in renal and bladder, and in hepatocellular carcinoma, all showing that folks are finding expression of RNA sequences off the human retrovirus.
And when do you see phase one starting? How far away is this from the clinic?
That's a funding and business issue. You know that. This isn't usually about science, folks. The science is driven by the money.
Well, who wants to pay Lou, and I'll take a 5% commission?
The reality is, you ask the question. There are some drugs that serendipitously were designed for other targets.
Defined Health would get the commission.
Yeah, right. Yeah. I mean, there's some drugs that serendipitously bind to some of these sequences. They weren't designed to do that. But in fact, they show profound clinical results. And we've seen that in large databases in prostate cancer. We're also seeing it in neurodegenerative disease. So, you know, if you shut down the sequences, it does work.
As an interesting sidebar to what was mentioned this morning, if you show that it works and you can pick a patient population for me, I'll get it from you right now.
We'll talk.
Sorry.
We'll see your press release being drafted.
Absolutely.
Tom, your view on the TME themes or targets that are exciting you?
Yeah, so to divide into categories, like I sort of set it up, in the T-cell inflamed tumors, most of the targets that are currently being addressed, both blocking antibodies against negative regulatory molecules and agonistic antibodies for costimulatory receptors, they're sort of plucked from a immunology textbook, right? Like, we've got CTLA-4 and PD-1, so what else is defined already, and can we tweak those and get some kind of impact? And what's kind of interesting is that as the field has actually focused in on tumor antigen-specific dysfunctional T cells in the tumor microenvironment, those cells are defined by a partially overlapping set of molecules, but there's a whole array of at least 100 different surface proteins that characterize those T cells. Many of those have never been interrogated before in immunobiology, and let alone in cancer immunology. And so instead of taking our cues from, a Nature Immunology review paper or the Janeway textbook, we can now take them. The techniques are all available, single-cell RNA-seq, just cell sorting and gene expression profiling, to understand what's the biology of dysfunctional T cells in the tumor microenvironment. So this is a very broad list of candidates. I want to comment about some of the existing agonistic antibodies. Some of those targets that we like are not so highly expressed on tumor antigen-specific TIL, right? And so they maybe they are not great candidates, right, to take forward into the clinic, and some of them are in the clinic. There are other defined ones that are still being addressed, and so I'm not saying it's not worth pursuing those. Issues of dose and schedule come up. For agonistic antibodies, I think that's completely unknown yet. Is it better to give one very infrequent dose, right, to sort of tweak a receptor and not
let's say, down-modulate it or whatever. So I think we have to think carefully about, more carefully about how to drug agonistic antibodies. So that's the T-cell inflamed. The non-T-cell inflamed, I mean, I think some of you know our approach has been to try and figure out why are T-cells not in the tumor microenvironment. There are cancer cell intrinsic oncogene pathways that are being pursued. Some of those are hard to drug, that are immune evasive. The first example that is druggable that we're working with is FGFR3, which is mutated in bladder cancer and overexpressed or mutated in multiple other epithelial cancers. That is exclusively mutated in non-T-cell infiltrated bladder cancers, 100%. And so of these putatively immune-evasive oncogene pathways, that's the first one where there's actually a drug, you know, or set of drugs in the clinic that can test this hypothesis. If you block a pathway that's exclusively on in cold tumors, can you now warm them up and then gain anti-PD-1 efficacy? So that's one example, but tumor cell intrinsic pathways. Innate immune activators, so I include in there oncolytic viruses that are not just killing tumor cells but are inducing local inflammation, including type 1 interferons, TNF, chemokines, all these juicy things. So oncolytic viruses, innate immune ligands, so TLR agonists that are being explored, STING agonists that we've worked on at our place, stereotactic radiation. I mean, this was raised about can you kill tumor cells. This has been... you know, we had shown in mice that stereotactic radiation actually, in part, is a STING agonist, and radiation fails in STING knockout mice. So this has been combined with anti-PD-1. Jason Luke was the PI of our trial that was published earlier this year. There are patients, it's about 13% of patients, when you give stereotactic radiation to one tumor, and these are bad patients, this isn't like, untreated melanoma patients, but about a 13% response rate in the non-irradiated tumors when you combine with anti-PD-1. So that's another strategy that's available to sort of piggyback onto. So innate immune activators, and then host factors. I alluded to the systemic immune modulatory effects of the gut microbiota. Another area that is starting to gain traction, I was really a doubter in the beginning, is the biologic role of bacteria that are in the tumor. I don't know if you guys have seen some of these data, but it looks like intratumoral bacteria set up therapeutic resistance, including to immunotherapies. And those bacteria, everybody thought, well, you know, maybe they're just stuck in the necrotic core of the tumor mass. But it looks like they're actually intracellular in the tumor cells, and the tumor cells are swimming around with these bacteria that they acquired from their tissue of origin. We haven't done any of this work, I think it's gaining traction in the field. And so is there a way to, I don't know, kill those bacteria or get rid of them or inhibit their function to restore efficacy in that subset? That's a very new direction.
So I guess if the tumor is sterile, or the sterility of the tumor... In other words, if something is growing or not growing is actually an interesting...
Yeah. It's. I mean, there are bacteria that have been shown to be pro-carcinogenic, right? So Helicobacter, right, is the classic example. Fusobacterium in colon cancer, I think, is... All the dots have been... I's have been dotted and T's crossed on that one. So, this is kind of a different biology, that somehow the bacteria end up incorporated into the cell when the cells divide, the bacteria divide, kind of like mitochondria. And then, what are they doing? And the emerging data, you know, suggests that they're mediating resistance. They metabolize chemotherapy. There was a science paper, right, about gemcitabine. It's metabolized by the bacteria, and so it can't kill pancreatic cancers. And it turns out there are data presented at meetings about immunotherapy efficacy thwarted by not just intratumoral bacteria, but intratumor cell bacteria. I think it's a little bit mind-boggling, but the data are looking good to me. Yeah.
So with the FGFR3, is that part of the extracellular matrix, the fibrosis, the fibrotic nest? You know, that's one of the themes that's emerging is, I guess, and certainly in pancreatic, you have this fibrotic nest and the T cells can't get in. Do you see any activity in that area as a theme?
So the FGFR3, I'm viewing it as just a signaling pathway, right? It's a tyrosine kinase domain containing growth factor receptor. It's probably, it's been billed as a driver oncogene. I'm not sure it's a driver oncogene on its own. In transgenic mice, if you overexpress it, it's hard to show that you're getting tumors. But if you block it, you can have tumors shrinking. So what's the exact function of that? I'm not sure. But we're viewing it as just a signaling pathway and trying to work out the biology of why it's immune evasive. About this extracellular matrix phenomenon, that was a very attractive idea, that pancreatic cancer, other tumors, you have this stroma, like just a physical barrier, so you know, presumably T cells can't get in. I'm not so convinced of that anymore. In the KRAS-driven mouse model, where it really looks like human pancreatic cancer, if you get activated T cells into those mice, they go right into the tumor, all right? So I don't think that that's a mandatory physical barrier. Second thing is we have MSI-high pancreatic cancer patients who respond to single-agent anti-PD-1. So they're just different because they have more antigens. And then the third is that Tony Rebus actually had pulled the desmoplastic melanoma data. Desmoplastic melanoma looks like pancreatic cancer. It's a few tumor cells with dense stroma. The response rate there to single-agent anti-PD-1 is like 70%. So despite dense stroma, T cells can get into these things, and I'm not sure that it's on its own, it's a rate-limiting physical barrier.
I want to pick up on one thing, Tom, you mentioned about the costimulatory agonists, right? I think this is a really good example of where the kinetics of biology really matters. I think what we've now started to see is many of those costimulatory receptors are not expressed on a lot of the effector cells, as you said, but there are things that can actually cause to their upregulation, right? So if you can actually think about ways in which to manipulate the effector cells to lead to an upregulation where you then pulsatile utilize these costimulatory receptors, you can actually make those inflamed tumors hyperinflamed,
yeah.
Right? So I think the kinetics of the microenvironment becomes really important.
Maybe we can shift to biomarkers or diagnostics. You know, what's the state of the art now on trying to figure out what's happening in the TME? You know, we now have some PET scan tracers. You know, there's all these new technologies coming in. Which ones are you guys excited about in terms of giving us what's really going on in the microenvironment so we can do that precision medicine?
I'll start. I'm very interested in getting as much information out of every patient as we possibly can. So I think that starts with a couple of things. One is every biopsy, actual tissue biopsy becomes really sort of such precious material. So you have to really approach it from the perspective of getting multiplex IHC, as much genomic data as you can via whole exome sequencing and other things as a sort of starting point. So you're getting essentially every bit of information genetically, genomically, pathophysiologically as is physically possible. But then to be able to track that with time via peripheral markers, whether you're looking at, you know, cell-free DNA or you're using, as you mentioned, imaging techniques to be able to image individual cell types. We have now started to use a PD-L1 tracer, which is essentially a way to image the equivalent of doing PD-L1 tracing via biopsy, but you now whole body image a patient. It's not perfect.
That's a PET scan using PD-1, is
that? That's right. So it's essentially an alternative molecule that binds to PD-L1, and so you can now do whole body evaluation of PD-L1 in an entire patient, and you can see, actually, we published some of this data, you can see different tumors within the same patient light up and don't light up, and within the tumor, certain portions of the tumor are more PD-L1 positive than negative. So you can imagine a core needle biopsy, if you got the wrong spot, you would misrepresent the patient. Well, now if you can make those sorts of assessments on a whole patient, you can get to a better understanding of which tumors are more likely to respond, but you can also go after those tumors where maybe you don't see PD-L1 light up and try to understand better what is the basis behind that, because it's not inherent to the patient. It's something unique to the individual sort of local microenvironment. And you can apply the same sorts of techniques with other radio tracers to try and label other cell types. We've started to try to label, for instance, CSF1R and other things where you can use those as sort of generic markers of tumor-associated macrophages and other things to get a sort of real-time assessment that you can do much more repetitively than you can do with biopsying an individual patient.
Yeah, I've seen several companies now labeling T-cells to try to, using the PET to try to see where the T-cells. So I think that's that may be an emerging theme. Bob, yeah. You had a comment you wanted to add on the biomarkers?
Yeah, so I actually think we have, the problem is we have a bounty of biomarkers, and we don't know which ones to be able to focus on. Each is expensive. And one of the problems, for example, we have as a small company is putting our own resources into the development of those biomarkers, both for treatment and also for response. That's not the sort of thing that we're ever going to make our money back on. We're going to give it away, ultimately, right, as a part of the treatment. And none of these have ever been subjected, for the most part, to multifactorial statistical analysis. So, you know, as we look at biomarkers as a one-off, many of them will survive statistical analysis because we're just looking at binary effects. But when we put together a multifactorial panel of biomarkers and ask which ones are predictive, almost none of them actually survive because it's so complex.
Dimitri, you wanted to?
Sure. So I think one of the problems with biomarkers in immunotherapy is, first of all, is heterogeneity. We base our biomarkers a lot of times on that pre-treatment biopsy. And where did we stick the needle? Did we stick it into the inflamed or non-inflamed part of the tumor, or is it an inflamed tumor or not inflamed tumor? So that's that's one thing. And then again, secondly, is really trying to understand like what is the predominance of specific things or specific immune microenvironment components, and what does that really mean? I'm much more interested in genetic biomarkers. Like, for example, for targeted therapies, you know, things like V600E mutation in BRAF that predicts for response to drugs like vemurafenib. But if we could have a genetic biomarker which defines whether the tumor microenvironment is going to be inflamed or not inflamed, and, you know, Tom has done some seminal contributions to that work defining the beta-catenin pathway, for example, tends to be suppressive. But we need a lot more of that data, and the data is coming out. Like, take, for example, a renal cell carcinoma, which is not a hypermutated tumor per se, but you know there are data, there are mutations in certain components of the chromatin remodeling complex, such as PBRM1, which is commonly mutated in that tumor, seems to be predictive of response to immune checkpoint blockade. We don't know why. Maybe it will come down to upregulation of these endogenous retroviral sequences, because again, these sequences come up as part of the chromatin remodeling. They normally suppress during the in a normal cell, but then upregulated once we mess up the tumor chromatin. So, but I mean, looking at these things, and the tumor genetics tends to be less heterogeneous than the microenvironment per se. And if we're able to define it with precision to say that, okay, the tumor has this mutation, therefore it is more likely to have a tumor immune infiltrate just based on the observations from the multiple tumors that we can have, I think there's going to be a much stronger predictive biomarker, if you will, rather than, you know, looking at a specific part of the tumor and trying to understand what is really happening. The other thing that I'm really excited, again, is, whole body imaging-based type of biomarkers that we have spoken about before, because, you know, that takes it away from this heterogeneity. That allows us to image all of the tumors. And again, if we do have a sensitive enough way to image tumor-infiltrating immune cells, whether this is CD8 cells or other cell populations, I think it will make it much easier for us to really understand what is going on in the entire host as opposed to, just a specific tumor.
Lou or Tom, anything to add to the, whether it's on imaging or biomarkers or?
Yeah, I'll just talk about imaging. I second the comments. And, you know, the fact is that there are a lot of efforts going on to build imaging agents, which look at PD-L1. My friend Mark Mansour this morning had some really good comments about clinical utility of actually imaging PD-1, and there are efforts going on there. You know, there are efforts going on looking at imaging CD8, imaging activated CD8s with other markers. The big animal in the room is these are all very interesting research questions in the development of drugs and the development of combinations in immunotherapy. PET imaging is expensive. And the way things are moving if we're really talking about large trials where we're treating a lot of patients and we're going to image a lot of patients, and especially if you talk about the commercial world, we're talking about F-18 PET.
We're not talking about gadolinium PET. We're not talking about these. It's got to be F18 because from a patient treatment standpoint, it's the only thing that can be done in a very short-term outpatient environment. So, but the reality is being able to document clinical decision-making benefit from the use of an F18 PET tracer at its cost from a reimbursement standpoint is not trivial. And so there are some of us who are deeply involved in taking that challenge on with the FDA, with CMS, with the private payers, so that when these agents actually get to the commercial field, which some of them will in fairly short order, within 3 years, the PD-L1s, the PD-1s, CD-8s, and possibly even the tracer that the National Cancer Institute, the F-18 tracer they're building, with one of these short RNA sequences from the human retrovirome, this is going to be an issue. So these may be great for research. We've got to figure out as an industry how we're going to get these things available for use in clinical medicine in a way that they can get paid for. It's probably going to devolve to putting them together in clinical trials, in approvals, and having them paid for as part of the drug cost, because separate payment, it's looking grim.
That's right.
Like it may not work.
That's right. That was really to my point before as well.
Right.
And even for a basic immunohistochemistry-based analysis, the cost of that for us for the development is actually quite extensive, and the accuracy has to be greater than 95%. And that's quite a bar to achieve. We're doing it because we have no choice, because we need to pre-select patients and be able to actually identify responses. But at some point, that gets absorbed in the cost of drug, at least to a point.
Tom, your views?
Yeah, I can add an additional angle, I think, which is for the kinds of biomarkers that we're exploring, there are two purposes. One is, can we find a predictive biomarker for response to drug X, or a set of biomarkers? But another is discovery around mechanisms of success versus failure, especially resistance mechanisms. And so we biopsy the hell out of everything, like Tim does, right? And I think we want to understand at baseline what are the true mechanisms of resistance to single agent anti-PD-1, and then when patients respond, what's happened in a pharmacodynamic way, or even if you started to modulate the tumor microenvironment, T cells are accumulating, the activated T cells are accumulating, but the patient didn't respond, what's rate limiting at that point? So I think the only way to really get a handle on that is to biopsy the tumor and analyze using our spectrum of assays. Again, single cell RNA-seq, gene expression profiling of the whole tumor gamish, complex multi-antibody immunohistochemistry, this immune fluorescence. This technique is getting better and better to do multispectral imaging. I was talking to one company over the weekend at the immunology meeting in Austin. Their development plan, they have right now 400 antibodies that they can stain one tumor biopsy within a 48-hour period. And so this is going to get up to be like whole protein analysis of the tumor microenvironment, not just like gene expression profiling in the tumor microenvironment. And so you can pick out then, candidate resistance mechanisms for interrogation back in the lab. And then same thing for secondary resistance. Patient responds, they recur, biopsy then. We have all of these technologies that are coming down in cost and improving in terms of specificity for discovery of resistance mechanisms. And I think that's how we're going to rationally target the relevant pathways for overcoming resistance.
I think Lou and Bob's points are spot on. We do have to think about the long term and the commercialization and the cost. But I think just to resonate with what Tom said, the near term is how do we actually design early signal seeking studies and do them better, so that we can actually use biomarkers to enrich to a patient population that at least we have a better biological belief. So that the example that was used this morning around a 10% response rate. Imagine a scenario where you could eliminate the bookends. You could eliminate 25% of the unlikely to respond on either end. So now the 10% response rate becomes a 35% response rate. We'd all be better off, and we'd know which drugs to use better. We then have to worry about, you know, sort of the downstream phenomenon around how do you decide how to implement a widely used biomarker strategy in terms of registrational programs. But I would still feel better and certainly feel better about the progress that we're making as an industry and as a community if we could utilize them even for the discovery and the early development triaging of molecules and mechanisms.
Well, Tim, question for you. You raised the importance of access to serial biopsies. In a perfect world, getting serial biopsies would be a good thing. But when you look at some of Bristol's trials, you mentioned cell-free DNA, obviously the tumor biopsy, the multiplex IHC, and now the PD-1 tracer. How often do you get to use these? How expensive are they? Just give the audience just a flavor for how often these can be applied and then some of the economic limitations. I guess a PET scan is several thousand dollars, but you know, I don't know how the system is billing it or reimbursing it.
Yeah. I mean, I think you know it all comes down to what are you going to be able to use the data for, and if you design the right experiments and you implement the biomarkers in such a way that it allows you to make more informed decisions, those costs actually become minuscule relative to having to do a big phase 2, phase 3 program that ends up failing. Right. So we have taken the approach of utilizing a very deep, aggressive biomarker strategy. And it's a constant learning, so don't get me wrong. We as an industry and as in partnership with our academic partners like Tom and others, we constantly evolve what we do and how we do it and when we take biopsies, and it varies. But if you do it right, then you actually are front-loading what is otherwise a very expensive drug development program with things that are going to save you enormously in the back end. And I think what you can do is if you have sort of broad spectrum understanding of a patient population, then you can sort of refine with time. I often tell my teams that we should sort of start at the beginning with maybe three or different choices from the proverbial menu, right? You've got a whole bunch of choices around target engagement and basic pharmacodynamic measures. And as you learn that you've sort of honed in on the right dose and sort of traditional pharmacology 101, you can wane away from those biomarkers, and then you focus more on patient selection criteria, and you ramp up those endpoints. They're going to be more specific to be able to pick the right patients, and you ramp up those things. So it's a sliding scale continuously, and you're utilizing the biomarkers for the purpose they're intended to be used for. And it's just that blind collection of information.
But for example, on the PD-1 tracer, you know, would that be used, let's just say, 3 or 4 times? In other words, how often do you think you'll be able to apply these new tools?
I think it depends on the program. So some of the innate immune agonist examples that Tom used earlier, that's a really good example where you can use a PET tracer to, A, define a priori those patients who are truly, quote-unquote, cold or non-inflamed. And then you can see, based upon where you inject, because many of them are intratumoral injection, you can see without having a biopsy, which somewhat confounds the nature of the experiment, you can see if the injected site becomes much more T-cell inflamed. You can also see if the non-injected sites become T-cell inflamed. And so if you did that 2 or 3 times kinetically, you now have a means by which to understand whether or not your agent is actually doing what you intended to do. The challenge with having to repetitively biopsy those patients is you're biopsying the same tissue site that you're also trying to track clinically, right? The biopsy or the use of the PET radiotracer allows you to sort of test that kinetics but still maintain those tumors for clinical assessments at the same time.
And in answer to your question about timing, with F-18 PET, you know, the technical reality is you literally probably can do non-confounded repeats at 3 weeks. From an FDA perspective, we're probably 60 days is probably pushing it.
What about the theme of single agent activity? Just again, your gut here. If you look at a checkpoint agent or a TME agent, do you think we need single agent activity as a filtration to go forward, or do you think we should, if we see great animal models or there's a good scientific mechanistic basis for a combination, even if monotherapy is negative, go forward? Dimitri, you were just...
I'm not a big fan of single agent activity. I mean, as we know, even with PD-1, which is probably the most successful immunotherapy we have, single agent activity is even in the most active cancers is still less than 50%, right? One could potentially design a trial where you start with a single agent and then you add on the second agent when you don't respond, and it makes sense, or you add on the third agent if you don't respond to the second agent. But in reality, the patients who progress, they get sick, and they cannot tolerate the next trial a lot of times. Doing this sort of sequential treatments does not always pan out. And the patients that do not get sick are the ones that perhaps are selected for not to get sick, and they might not be representative of the entire population of the patients that should get sick if their cancer grows. So I'm not a big fan of necessarily, waiting whether the single agent works or not. Maybe in some cancer types where we know the single agent activity is very high, let's take MSI high cancers, it's certainly worthy of pursuing a single agent therapy experiment first and then adding on a second drug. But for most of the cancers, we know that, the likelihood of responding to the single agent is really low. So I'm always more of a, pro the approach of making a best guess for a specific combination. It could be a biomarker-based approach, but the biomarker that's obtained upfront, as opposed to a biomarker that's obtained, let's say, at the time of progression. Because, first of all, at the time of progression, patients might not be interested in getting that biopsy. They just want to get the hell out of the clinical trial and go on to their standard therapy, if there is a standard therapy that exists. Or, again, they may be too sick to participate in the next line of therapy. So I think we need to be defining those things earlier on rather than necessarily at the end.
Tom, your views on this?
Well, the
theme comes up because of the IDO failure. People say, oh, there was no single agent activity. It's the famous retrospectoscope. Of course, that's why it didn't work. But again, that wasn't said before. All of the effort was made and energy to invest in all the IDO trials.
Yes. I mean, maybe I was going to say something else, but to start with IDO, I would say that we don't know what the single agent activity really is for the Insight compound, because the phase one trial was mostly colorectal cancer patients and there weren't disease-specific phase two trials done. And so, what is known is there were two melanoma patients who had progressed on IPI and then had prolonged disease stabilization on single agent epacadostat, but then the move was made very quickly to go to combinations, right? So I think we don't know, but what the single agent activity really is in different diseases. But obviously, ideally, you want single agent activity in some cancer. And take the combination that we do have FDA approved, which is IPI-NIVO, right? Just looking back, IPI as a single agent is, as a 10% response rate in melanoma. That's, in retrospect, that's not a very high response rate, but it's detectable. It has a minimal response rate in other cancers, and now we've got IPI-NIVO for kidney cancer, right, as a combo. So once you know there's single agent activity in some cancer, and then see, in let's say a phase one with expansion cohorts, activity that looks greater than anti-PD-1 alone, just because we're focused on anti-PD-1 combos, that's really reassuring, right, to check all those boxes. But it doesn't mean you need single agent activity validated in every cancer type. I think then you can move to combos. And then, there are two other bits of trial design. Let's say the epacadostat trial is a true negative. It might be a false negative, but if it's a true negative, what other filters should be applied ideally to early combination drug development? So besides single agent activity, small randomized phase two trials where you have exactly the same patient population at a contemporary time period with the same centers that are going to be doing the larger randomized trial. I think that can give you a bunch of information, and it seems like it adds a year and a half to drug development or something. But you're really going to be reassured if you see a double response rate or something in your combo arm with a contemporary control arm, even if it's not statistically significant, but to see that trend. And then another variable is seeing combination efficacy in anti-PD-1 failures. I mean, there can be late responders, delayed response to anti-PD-1 occasionally. It's actually not that common. We have several phase one trials where there are no responders in anti-PD-1 failures, and so I'm pretty confident that if we see, some reasonable response rate with a combo in anti-PD-1 failures, that there's probably going to be a signal there. CTLA-4 meets that criterion, too. We know we have an in-house trial, anti-PD-1 failure melanoma patients. Then they get CTLA-4, PD-1, and that response rate is quite high. And so I think that's another strategy that can be taken early. I know some of the big pharma companies are amending trials to have randomized phase two designs, or definitely including cohorts that are anti-PD-1 failures. I don't know if Tim has.
Yeah, there's maybe two things I'd offer. One is the trial design components that Tom just pointed to. I think making sure that your patient population allows for a very clear understanding of the signal, whether they're PD-1 resistant refractory patients, or their tumors like pancreatic cancer, late-line pancreatic cancer, where you know that essentially nothing works, then you can believe those signals. I think the other thing that I would say, though, is that back to the single agent, you know, clinical evidence of single agent activity would be spectacular. But I think biological evidence, the single agent does what it's intended to do, is perhaps as good, if not better than a lot of other things. Truly understanding that why you designed your molecule to hit a target and to lead to some biological consequence, if you can demonstrate that in human beings, then you can at least test the hypothesis to feel comfortable that the outcome of your clinical trial will have appropriately tested that.
I'm glad you raised that point. Like, for example, the intratumoral innate immune activators, TLR agonists, TVEC, right? I think if you can get to the point where you've got tumors that are really, you know, the coldest of the cold, the rocks, right? And you now, in half the patients at your biologically active dose, have now a new immune infiltrate. I mean, the patients who start off with an immune infiltrate, their tumor is progressing, right? And so the tumor is coexisting with that immune infiltrate already, and then you intervene with anti-PD-1 and you get regression. So it could be we'll have patients, you know, you have a rip-roaring T-cell infiltrate, but PD-1 and so on, negative regulation kicks in. And so if you at least get that, like a rip-roaring T-cell inflamed phenotype in what was a rock, now, and maybe not a big response rate, you could still argue for the combination because you've had the biologic effect.
Lou, a quick comment, and then we'll go to the audience.
In terms of clinical trial design, I had a really interesting question from the head of a large multi-institution IRB yesterday who said that, now, you know, in terms of clinical trials that we're evaluating in combination immunotherapy, doesn't the Merck KEYNOTE-189 trial really throw a monkey wrench in here and raise the bar for us? Is it actually ethically okay for us to approve clinical trial designs that don't have chemotherapy in them? It was a very interesting question, and frankly, I think it's one that's going to start resonating. The results that they saw, of course, were pretty profound of Keytruda plus double agent chemotherapy. And so from an IRB standpoint, from an FDA standpoint, I think these questions are going to start popping up. Is single agent? You want to use a single agent here? But look at what happened in human patients in KEYNOTE-189. So I think we need to be aware of there's a little bit of a storm coming.
Yeah. Well, it would be later stage patients for single agent.
Yeah. Yes, sir. Yeah. Just picking up on the theme of imaging agents and real-time monitoring as a means to make treatment decisions in real time. We got into this yesterday in our diagnostics panel, the idea of adaptive treatment. The idea of imaging agents to be able to monitor whether tumors are being infiltrated in real time or near real time, I admit that I didn't realize that that was a thing, and that's very cool and exciting to hear about. My question is, does that adds a cost, and that introduces disruption into the treatment algorithm, one that would be justified if it does better than what we currently have, which I guess is monitoring of scans and seeing if the tumor is progressing on its own. And ultimately, you want to know not only if the tumor is hot or cold, I would believe, but why, and if there are particular resistance mechanisms emerging that are druggable. I'm just wondering, are we going in this direction, or is it too high of a bar to introduce additional diagnostics into the treatment algorithm, in the context of the fact that you're adding a couple of $1,000 on top of what's already, let's say, $10,000 or $12,000 a month in therapy?
I think it depends on its utilization. Right now, it's very clearly for exploration. it's utilized to be able to inform early clinical trials and be able to pick the right patients and understand what's biologically happening. It is not ready for randomized control types of assessments, but hopefully we get to a point in which it will be utilized in that way. It would also be informative to be able to utilize, if you could do sort of a whole patient imaging, then you can utilize those sorts of endpoints to correlate with maybe easier endpoints to collect, whether they're peripheral blood markers, other things, and once you can draw those correlates, maybe you then have an easier path towards something that is more tractable in a larger clinical trial setting.
And just a quick comment, probably the first commercialized biomarker imaging agent will be the PYL-F18 PSMA in prostate cancer, which is in the prostate cancer field, everybody's wild about it. And so this will probably be the first one commercially out there, and the reality of what happens in terms of clinical decision-making and will it get paid for is going to influence all the rest of the work that we're doing. That's going to be the lead model that really determines how this stuff's going to get paid for. And it's, just as a slight correction, it's about $6,000 for an F-18 PET agent.
So just to add on that, the daratumumab, also a radio-labeled, that's more to assess whole body whether the disease is still there. So that's another way of assessing minimal residual disease. Where else is it that might not be picked up with and protein disappearing? But my question to you folks is, so I heard you got sample bias with a biopsy. You got expensive. You got potential integration into selecting patients. What do you have for soluble bloodborne markers that's associated with what's going on in the microenvironment?
Not a whole lot today, to be very honest with you. I mean, there are some small examples. Nacho Molero has started to talk about measurement of IL-8 as a potential predictive marker of non-responsiveness to PD-1 therapies. There are things like that can be measured in a serum cytokine panel very easily. We're going to test that hypothesis. We have an anti-IL-8 antibody that we're actually prospectively going to test the hypothesis in a patient population that has failed PD-1 therapy, who has high levels of IL-8 as measured via serum sample. Can you actually bring those patients back to response? But that's just one minor example that's really around a target rather than it is on a general theme.
So is anybody doing cytokine panels to basically just...
Yeah, sure. Yeah, maybe that's one thing. So there are a couple issues with circulating biomarkers. So first of all, when we even study T cells specific for tumor antigens, their biology in the circulation is different from their biology in the actual tumor site. So they don't necessarily line up. The second thing is that circulating biomarkers, cells or soluble factors that are related to the tumor or the immune system emanating from the tumor or driven by the tumor, are impacted by tumor bulk. So the dominant factor driving the circulating biomarkers is how much tumor there is in the patient. But we know, I just had a patient I saw, what day is today? Yesterday in clinic, had kilograms of tumor responded to single-agent anti-PD-1, right? And then I have another patient, tiny little things, right, completely resistant, right? And so both I saw in the same day, right? So a serum biomarker wouldn't have even been sensitive enough to pick up the patient, indicator of the biology of the tumor microenvironment if somebody has just in-transit metastases with melanoma, right? So I think these are intrinsic limitations to the circulating compartment to think about an indicator of the tumor microenvironment. There's been one study from Penn about, well, if you take a mathematical ratio of your marker to tumor bulk, maybe you can get closer. But now we're starting to get into kind of a slippery slope, I believe. Unbiased screens of circulating factors are super interesting. So complete proteomic analysis of the serum, baseline and with therapy. We have a project with total mass spec small molecule metabolomic analysis. And there are metabolites linked to response, right? So some of those metabolites come from normal tissues. Some of them come from the tumor or immune cells, right? Some of them come from diet. Some of them come from microbiota, right? So maybe this kind of unbiased just protein bashing and mass spec, you know, total molecular profiling bashing will reveal something new that's not influenced so much by tumor bulk.
Yeah, and I was just going to add to that that Tom alluded to this earlier. So one of the sort of emerging biomarkers that is currently used is profiling of TCR repertoires, and you can basically look at the TCR repertoire within the tumor, and then in the peripheral blood, you find your clones in the tumor and then the same clones in the peripheral blood, and then if they are emerging in response to a PD-1 blockade, some studies have demonstrated that that may be predictive of response. This is obviously just sort of very rough approximation, but with newer technologies such as single-cell RNA-seq, you're now able to profile both what is the profile, you know, first of all, find these specific TCRs in the peripheral blood and find what is the, you know, the phenotype of that T-cell, and then as you apply it more and more, we're hoping that we'll be able to identify the T cells that are really reactive to the tumor microenvironment. And it doesn't mean that every patient will eventually need to undergo single-cell RNA-seq. It's more like if we're able to define these biomarkers, we can then apply cheaper assays, even flow cytometry, to perhaps identify these T cells in the periphery and see how they respond to the tumor. Yeah.
Jeff?
All right, so we'll go for 5 more minutes, despite the clock. And then we'll take a mini break if anyone needs it, and then we'll start maybe at 11:20. But my question, to take us back to Mark's original question about top favorite targets. So what, there's 1,200, 1,500 combination trials. Pick your number. We also saw Mike Gree showed one of the slides from yesterday that I showed about how much investment is going into mostly cell therapies and antibodies of various sorts, including bispecifics. So my question is, we have a plethora of known targets. We have a lot of cell types and pathways that can be drugged. We have a lot of combination trials ongoing now. Are we investing where we should be as an industry, both academic and industry side, or are we missing things that are right in front of us, not necessarily the one-off unknown target that, you know, one group has published on, but, you know, are we doing the right thing, or are we too consolidated and chasing too much of the same thing?
I think there's an enormous disconnect between ongoing clinical trials, most of which are small institutional studies at this point, many of which I think everybody would admit don't make a lot of sense, compared to where the science is, which is quite advanced. And so the science is not informing institutional clinical trials. So of these 2,300 trials that we always refer to, you know, the vast majority of those are probably not going to be informative, and they are trials of opportunity. And they're not being scientifically driven. I think that's the real problem here.
Anyone else for Jeff's comment?
I think one of the problems that I see is the same as what was discussed during the previous session, in that we're focusing, all of the trials are focusing on the same cancer types. I mean, I cannot tell you that even within our institution how many trials we have just specifically focusing on lung, bladder, melanoma, and perhaps kidney cancer. And then they're competing and sort of cannibalizing on each other, and we're not necessarily really getting the right answer out of these. I think that there needs to be more focus on other cancer types, and you can learn the biomarkers from other cancer types and apply them back to these more common cancers. But I think this is one of the limitations we're having. Like that, you know, I have a line of GI patients that are lined up for trials for which we have really no combinations and no drugs, and then, you know, 20 trials ongoing in lung cancer for which we have no patients, even in the post-PD-1 progression setting.
I think Bob's comments resonate with me. I think there's probably just a lag time between our learnings and the science and the actual clinical trials. A lot of the trials today were trials of opportunity, trials of companies that are trying to sort of get into the space and do things like that. But as we've learned, some of the newer trials in the phase one studies are much more patient selection driven, much more around trying to understand, you know, pairing the biology of a particular tumor type or a subsegment of those with new mechanisms. And you just don't see that. Those are not as visible to the outside world, nor are they, frankly, that visible even within CT.gov, because people like me are incredibly good about trying to mask what we're actually doing in an initial CT.gov posting. You know, so I think there's just an opportunity there to learn more with time.
I mean, to Jeff's point, are we doing enough with radiation, with some of the old chemotherapeutics, some of the kinase inhibitors, some of the anti-angiogenics? Maybe they're not, you know, scientifically exciting now because they've been around for a while, but are we exploiting the low-hanging fruit?
I think the low-hanging fruit is being explored pretty well. I mean, and like on the academic side, we're assuming that, I mean, companies are going to combine with standard of care in each cancer, and they'll figure out which ones look good and which ones don't. And there isn't a lot of like discovery-driven thought that we have to lend to those, experiments, clinical experiments from the academic perspective. But I think it does seem like, the streetlight is on the same kind of approaches with, many different companies, right? And many of these combination trials, I mean, how many combination trials of the same type do we need, nationwide and so on? But in my mind, the streetlight has to focus some on what's actually going on with T cells in the tumor microenvironment and what are the rate-limiting steps there. And the new sort of drug development and discovery platforms should be driven by those signals. And then for the immune targets, not necessarily what's in an immunology textbook, but what's really characteristic of T cells in real tumors in mouse models and in human models. Yeah.
All right. Any last-minute comments? Lou, you want to get the last word in?
Yeah, sure. I mean, just the question that Jeff asked was kind of, are we investing in the right things? And I don't think as a financial industry in biotech we usually do invest in the right things. The comments that folks have made are absolutely correct, I think, from a scientific basis. But if you look at the amount of money going into autologous cell therapy from an investment standpoint, last week, this week, it's phenomenal. But 3 weeks ago, CMS basically said, look, we're not going to pay for autologous T-cell therapy. That's not exactly what they said, but they came close to it. And so I think the investment community is just beginning to look. I've had several comments this week from investment analysts saying, is that really what CMS said? What are the Q2 sales of Kymriah actually going to be, since we're hearing from clinicians that they're canceling blood draws for the initial Kymriah therapy, given what CMS said? So I don't think this isn't a science question. This is a reimbursement question. And so often we invest in science that probably isn't practicable from a clinical point of view.
Okay. Well, anyway, next year I think we'll have a panel on novel PET tracers and whole body sequencing.
Let's do it.
For the Cancer Progress 2019. I want to thank the panelists. That was a great discussion. Thank you.